My name is Joshua Gibson, and you are listening to the Philosophical Weightlifting Podcast, a show dedicated to promoting a message of critical thinking as it pertains to strength training, nutrition, and well-being. This is done through interviews with experts, high-level athletes, coaches, and people heavily involved in strength sports and athletic development. Pull up a chair, grab a coffee, and let's get on to today's podcast. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Philosophical Weightlifting Podcast. My name is Joshua Gibson. I'm your host, and I'm joined today by Dustin Aranchuk. Dustin, how's it going?
Yeah, it's going good. I'm on a little bit of a vacation right now, so I'm pretty well rested and happy to be on the show.
Yeah, well rested, underworked, two great things that I don't think many people get. But maybe you can kind of fill us in. You said you're on vacation now. You said you're a fan of the NFL, but you're from Canada. Is that kind of common?
Oh yeah, that's pretty common. I mean, we have our Canadian Football League, which is semi-popular, but not nearly as big as the NFL. So pretty much everybody who's a CFL fan is also an NFL fan. So I've been following the NFL to some degree, probably since 1999. There was the greatest show on turf with the St. Louis Rams at the time. So that's kind of how I fell into it. That was the first Super Bowl I watched. But no, it's not uncommon for there to be NFL fans up in Canada. I've got a fantasy football league and things like that that help me be entertained.
How was the actual game itself?
Yeah, the game was cool. So that was the Seattle Seahawks and Arizona Cardinals, because I'm in Phoenix at the moment. So the stadium is about twice as big as the CFL stadium in Calgary. And the game itself was decent. It wasn't the most exciting game in the world. Didn't go to overtime, wasn't particularly high scoring, but it was still kind of a bucket lister. So I was certainly happy to go.
Yeah, and you've been involved with athletics now, for quite some time. And we were talking off air about your involvement with SNC type work for hockey. Have you always been into, and I think I've actually seen you maybe publish research on looking at things related to maybe golf performance or something like that. Have you always been a guy who's been pretty into athletics and different sports and more generally human performance?
Yep, you could definitely say that. So growing up, like a lot of people who probably are listening to this podcast and probably yourself, play a lot of sports and things like that growing up. And then one of my first job ever, paid job, was like a cart boy at IKEA. And then a few years later, my second job was in a private sort of high performance strength and conditioning type facility, just cleaning weights and stocking the fridge and wiping down benches and things like that. And then that was part of the reason why I decided to earn my first degree in kinesiology or exercise science or whatever you'd like to call it. So it started pretty early. So just being in that environment probably since I was around 15 or at the latest 16 years old. And here I am almost 33, not quite. So quite literally half my life has been spent at least partially in those environments.
Yeah, and I'll definitely like to get into your experience doing that. But we did talk off air, and maybe I'm just kind of whetting the appetite of people without really giving them access to the conversation. But we talked a bit about your undergraduate and then graduate work, and we kind of talked about the state of going into teaching versus research, specifically in kind of these smaller sports and maybe just sports science as a whole. But when you went into your undergraduate, and that's kind of what I do, it's like exercise science, kinesiology, like human, like health and human kinetics. It's all kind of interchangeable. Do you think it kind of scratched that itch for you and provided you with a good platform to be an effective strength coach or whatever your jobs were after that in those sports? Because I've kind of always thought about like the state of exercise science and then the state of sports science and then even kind of where those differ, but where even sports science falls a bit short in providing us with a lot of like really high quality information that we can put into practice pretty seamlessly. So what was your experience like kind of going through the education process in kinesiology or exercise science?
Yeah, so I would say in general, well, and I mentioned to you before, I didn't do very well in my undergrad. You know, my grades were not particularly good or anything like that. And later on down the road through the master's and to the PhD, I started to excel, partially because at that point you have a lot more independence. Now, I can't speak for all programs, but the kinesiology program at the University of Calgary is extremely high ranked, you know, the, in terms of research and the professors and things like that. It's, I think it was last year, it was ranked like the number one sports science program in North America and probably top 10 in the world or something. However, at the time, at least, and of course, this is now about 10 years ago, but I doubt it's changed much. The vast majority of the curriculum and the required courses is more suited at that school to getting people into physical therapy programs or getting them into med school or other sort of programs beyond it. And very little of the courses were designed to actually help somebody become a sports science practitioner or a strength and conditioning coach or even a personal trainer. So I think that was probably a large reason of why I didn't do very well in classes, because I found myself learning far more in my, you know, part-time work on the side in sports performance facilities. And I was like, man, like I'm learning so much more here. I'm just going to focus in on this and kind of like just do enough to get my C's and get my degree at the end of things. So part of that's on me and part of it is on the fact that at a school, at a big university like that, the majority of efforts put into, you know, medical school and health and trying to help people with cancer or other diseases.
This podcast is brought to you by Onyx Weightlifting Co. I've been very selective about finding sponsors for the show, but after much deliberation, in conversation with Chris and Danny, the co-owner and founder, we decided that Onyx is beyond a great fit to support this podcast. Onyx is a brand built on providing the strongest and most comfortable straps, wraps, belts, and apparel to the weightlifting community, with the leather products handcrafted by the same barbell calloused hands that you have. Make sure you pick up something today at onyxstraps.com using the code PhilWL for 10% off of your purchase. That is onyxstraps.com, onyxstraps.com, using the code PHILWL for 10% off of your purchase. And thanks as always for supporting the show. Yeah. And did you find that, obviously you kind of mentioned the fact that you did much better in your graduate work. Did that change much as you went into the master's program and then to the doctoral program?
Yeah, it did. So in the master's program, like we actually had like a dedicated strength and conditioning class or even two of them. And a lot of the projects that you might have done in, you know, your biomechanics course or your physiology course, you could tailor them to what you were interested in, as opposed to with the physiology course. If you are interested in clinical populations, then you could do a project, do your presentations on how to, you know, perform cardiac rehabilitation for somebody who's recently had a heart attack. Or you could tailor that same project to how do you prepare an athlete for to run 800 meter sprint. So there's just a little bit more autonomy in those types of things. And it was a smaller school as well that sort of prided itself on athletics. Part of the draw there was that I was also the graduate assistant strength and conditioning coach for a few of the teams. So that kind of helped to blend those two worlds. And you have your master's thesis where I was able to get the men and women swimming and diving team to be my participants. So it was just, it was a more enjoyable, more autonomous experience. And then on top of that, I knew what it was like to not have good grades and to have to, you know, go pretty far away from home to a small university in order to get into a master's program. And I didn't want that to hold me back in the future. So even though when I entered the program, I had no intention of eventually earning a PhD, I just kind of like said, well, if you change your mind in 3 years, you don't want to be in the same boat where you like just barely passed your master's program and now you can't get in anywhere, or you got to upgrade or something like that. So I just took it a lot more seriously. And that's just the benefit of time and experience and a little bit of age.
And then with your PhD work, when you got into the program and you're kind of deciding what you wanted to focus on and study, maybe you can talk about the topics you ended up looking at, kind of the work you did, and then I guess your experience as a whole going through that, given, you know, your background that you just kind of talked about.
Yeah. So basically it was about halfway through the master's program when I was like, you know what, I'm teaching right now, I'm doing some research, I'm coaching as well, but I really like this teaching thing and I really like this research thing as well. And let's, you know, the whole plan there becomes, all right, well, if we want to teach and or do research and have somebody pay you to do it, you know, you don't need a PhD, but you almost need it. It's pretty much a requirement if you want to do that, at least at a major university, anywhere that's sort of desirable for most people to live. So, okay, let's start picking away at that. So my first step was find a place / find supervisors that you would want to work with. So I went through my master's thesis, which was, you know, pretty far from being complete, but well on its way. And I went and I just kind of read through the reference list and I was like, well, who are the people that appear the most in this reference list? And, you know, there was one person from the University of Toronto, and then there was two people from AUT, Auckland University of Technology, which is where I wound up. And there's, you know, this person over here and that person over there. And, you know, there's Stone from East Tennessee State University, which you mentioned Guy Hornsby earlier. So that was something. And then you send out emails and you see who comes back. And a couple people came back. A couple people did not. They didn't reply at all. A couple people replied back saying, oh, yeah, that'd be great. But we don't have any funding. There's no scholarships available for first-time students or, you know, whatever, what have you. And so eventually just places kind of dropped off the block. So as a Canadian, I'm not used to paying a ton of money for university. So, you know, like East Tennessee State was like, oh, okay, like we don't give any scholarships to first year PhD students. And I'm looking at what, international tuition costs, and I was like, oh geez, I would like quadruple the amount of debt I have for just 1 year, or something like that. So I kind of crossed that one off, and so that's how I ended up at AUT. People replied, there were scholarships potentially available, worked hard to publish and get good grades and things like that, and then that sort of fell into place. And then when it came to putting together a project, a couple of different ideas were sort of pitched to me, which I considered. So the only one I remember outside of, well, let's see. The first one that I remember the most clearly that we didn't go for was to try and look at something similar to, you know, if there was video, I'd be doing my air quotes here, but structural balance, sort of as proposed by people like Charles Poliquin. So it's basically the idea that if you can bench press X, you should be able to do a dumbbell external rotation with Y, and you should be able to do a dip with Z, and you should be able to do a narrow grip pull up with, you know, Q. And if you're outside of those ranges by a large amount, then you're potentially at a greater risk for injury, or you're leaving kilos on the table or whatever else. So that's an interesting topic. I still like that topic, but I found that the more experience I get in strength and conditioning, hands-on, whether it's training myself or training other people, sort of the less likely I am to think like, oh yeah, your external rotation is like a little bit too weak and that's what's holding back your bench press. Like, it's probably not the case unless you're just kitten weak in one and Hulk strong in the other. So I kind of looked at that as like, oh, it's an interesting topic, but I feel like whatever we find would be like, well, it actually doesn't matter. And that didn't really excite me as a potential finding. And then the other sort of general topic, it must have been something a little bit more specific, but had something to do with velocity-based training. So, you know, what kind of velocity cutoffs you might want to find in order to maximize a specific adaptation. So again, I don't remember how far along that topic we got. And then the third topic that probably interested me the most and the one that we ended up going with was looking at what we had deemed quasi-isometric training or eccentric quasi-isometric training, which basically just means holding an isometric contraction, like you're holding a dumbbell or a cable station or something like that, and trying to resist it from pulling you or moving your joint for as long as possible, followed by a max effort eccentric contraction. And part of the reason that was cool was, that was an idea that my tertiary supervisor, Andre, who was in Melbourne, was interested in. So if I had kind of chosen that topic, not only did I think it was, you know, at least somewhat interesting, but it would involve, a 6 month or 9 month period over in Melbourne, where we would use some of his expertise of taking muscle samples and blood samples and looking at muscle fiber type changes and metabolic processes and things like that, a little more biological. And I looked at that as an opportunity to gain some skills that would eventually hopefully help with employment as a researcher down the road. And I mentioned to you briefly, like, all that really didn't work out because of COVID. But that was sort of the logic behind that choice.
Yeah. And then I guess that was what had birthed the paper that we're actually going to talk about today, which is a systematic review looking at isometric training and long-term adaptation. So that, I'm assuming this was kind of the piece that was setting up the ground on which the more specific research you did was kind of founded on.
Yep, that would be correct. So programs, at least in Australia and New Zealand, so Oceania, typically follow a pretty similar pattern. So you'll do a systematic review, potentially with a meta-analysis if your topic is well established enough. On your topic, you might then write a second review perhaps, and then you might do some piloting and then do sort of an acute study or a cross-sectional study, and then finish it up with a training study. And then the goal would be to publish all of those. So kind of started off in that way, but the thing with quasi-isometric training or EQIs is that there's really, especially EQIs, is there's literally, well, maybe not literally, but there's practically zero direct evidence. Like, nobody's ever run a training study, at least that I could ever find. Maybe somebody who never published it in, you know, North Korea or something did something on it. But there's nothing out there. So how do you write a systematic review on something that doesn't exist? Well, the truth is you can't. So the closest we did was, okay, we'll write a systematic review on simply isometric training in general. So different joint angles, so long versus short muscle lengths, different intensities, you know, pushing as hard as you possibly can versus holding, you know, 50% of the contraction for, you know, 2 minutes straight or what have you, or the intent. So ramping up into it versus really trying to explode into it. And that's what the review was all about. And then from there, we built on that. And I wrote a narrative review on EQIs and then started in on the actual studies. But yeah.
Okay. So let's
paper.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's actually a great place to start, which is kind of dissecting isometrics as a whole and looking at them from, you know, the lens of what they are, why they're used, what they you know are shown to do, and then how people can best use them. That's kind of all umbrellaed under this performance kind of approach, specifically with weightlifting and powerlifting, given that this is like a strength power podcast. So isometric training, maybe you can explain, and you touched on it there, the different types of isometrics, and then we can kind of start getting into what's happening under the hood and kind of go from there.
Yeah. So the different types of isometrics. So as I previously mentioned, you know, you'd have the different joint angles and the different intensities and the different intents. And then what I mean by sort of the quasi isometrics, or the other phrasing that you can use would be pushing isometrics versus holding. The exact same terms, just in different words, would be your yielding versus overcoming isometrics. So what I would say would be traditional isometrics, overcoming isometrics, and pushing isometrics, or I guess the other task would be a force task. Those would involve pushing against an immovable object. So you're trying to move a wall, or you have a barbell that's underneath, you know, pins in a squat rack, and you're trying to use your legs to sort of squat it up, but of course it's not going to move anywhere, or a bench press of the same nature. Those would be your holding, pushing, force task, or traditional isometrics. And then on the other hand, if you are basically resisting gravity or resisting the pull of a cable station or a partner is trying to move you, and you're resisting that, so holding a push-up position, holding like a midpoint of a push-up for time, or taking a bar off of a squat rack, you know, you step it out and then you go halfway down and you hold that position. Those would be your yielding isometrics or your holding isometrics or your position task isometrics. And then there's at least some evidence that those are for sure neurally different. So the way that your body controls those tasks is certainly different. And then there's no evidence that I can find that shows that the adaptations are different. You know, if you did that for a period of 6 weeks, you know, what would happen to the tendon, to the nervous system, to the muscle? That's sort of yet to be determined. Although I will say, myself and another researcher, Danny Lum, are currently working on something in that way. I don't really want to speak to it just yet, but it's sort of coming. And then I'm also very slowly, I might add, picking away at a systematic review comparing holding and pushing isometrics. But at this point, 100% of the studies, there's quite a few studies, there's something like 50 studies that compare them. But all 50 of them are acute, like just, you know, one sort of snapshot, or, you know, within an hour or two. So no actual training adaptation.
Yeah. So you mentioned the effects are different when someone pushes into pins versus kind of like stops on the during the eccentric and holds. Is that kind of like obviating load? If you were just performing the task with I guess, similar like force outputs, the adaptations would be similar? Is that the idea?
The adaptations, again, I can't for sure speak to that, but if we look at the literature where it's comparing the two and looking at what's going on either neurally or in like blood flow terms or whatever, then there do seem to be some different effects, even if the force is the same. So, you know, if we use the squat for an example, because I think that's probably one of the more relevant examples to your listeners, whether it be a squat or a snatch pull or something like that, and you're pushing up into the pins versus just holding that position, and the person was on force plates, okay? So if you had them looking at a screen with the force time curve, and so they're pushing up into the rack and the force plates are coming out with, I don't know, 150 kilograms of force, and they're holding that versus having their body weight plus whatever make 150 kilograms and they go down to that same knee joint angle and they hold that, there are differing, there's the nervous system is behaving a little bit differently in terms of how fatigued it's getting, the blood flow to the agonist versus antagonist muscles is likely to be a little bit different. And again, I'm a little bit, I'm stretching the literature a little bit because almost all of it is in open chain movements like a bicep curl or a leg extension, not a squat. But you would imagine it would probably have similar effects in terms of, it seems like in general, with a few studies being the exception, that the holding isometric is more fatiguing. It creates more fatigue. People typically cannot hold it as long as, you know, when they're pushing into the pin with the same amount of force. And the blood flow is more restricted to the antagonists, probably because at that point you're not just using your quads and glutes. You're also kind of having to stabilize and co-contract with the hamstrings, and the core and, you know, the hip flexors or whatever else so that you don't over push and change your joint angle. So there are differing effects.
Do you think those effects have, so kind of like the idea of research that's been done on cluster training, the outcomes can be different. You know, there can be a significant difference, like a meaningful change in performance. But you wonder, like in the realm of like an entire training plan or program, how that, like if that actually becomes additive or if it kind of becomes noise. So if you do clusters specifically and you do that over, you know, 8, 12, 16 weeks, is there this like micro effect where those small little differences and maybe like power output or bar trajectory, if those small differences add up over time and create like a more significant change that would enhance performance, do you think there's some sort of like micro effect with the different isometrics if you were to use one over the other and say this is, you know, creating more of the effect that we want? There are also different adaptations between the two. So if we do like an overwhelming amount of, you know, A, then we're going to get some small effect down the line that is actually meaningful. Or do you think these differences kind of wash out in, you know, in like actual training during like a 16-week macro cycle?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question. So I can't say with 100% certainty because it just hasn't been done. But my instinct tells me that, yeah, I think it would be additive if you did do a long enough study. You know, I think like 16 weeks would be fantastic. Of course, very difficult to pull off. But yeah, if you did a 16-week study comparing yielding versus overcoming isometrics in a squat at a certain angle, do I think you would see a difference in like muscle size and jumping ability and, you know, the ability to absorb force, for example, or even like tendon thickness? Yeah, I think that's a pretty realistic possibility. So, you know, somebody's just gotta go ahead and do it. So that's why it's sort of fun to talk about these things on podcasts or whatever, because, you know, chances are, You know, maybe I'll be the one to do it someday and maybe not, but it gets, hopefully one or two researchers will see that. And hopefully one of them is like, oh, that's interesting. I'd like to try that. Let's do it. But yeah, how it would affect it, I'm not exactly sure. I think that in terms of, I would imagine that you would get more muscle hypertrophy from a yielding contraction because you get all the other co-contractors working. So all of the little muscles and the antagonist muscles working. And then probably in terms of like jump height or other explosive type measures, you'd probably get a better result with the pushing or the overcoming isometrics because it's going to be the same sort of intent as trying to jump as high as you can. You know, but then if one has a larger effect on tendon, you know, thickness and viscoelasticity, then maybe that's the one that actually helps people jump higher because you're going to get more elastic energy from the tendon. And it doesn't actually matter how specific the, you know, that maybe overcomes the specificity of the nervous system. So hard to say, but I think they are different enough where, given a long enough time frame and a big enough sample size, you could see a difference.
And I think that the pushing isometrics are far less used. I think I've seen maybe two coaches, and they've probably been, you know, spoken about here and there, but I've seen like two coaches that I can think of who have used them. One more recently, it's actually Will Fleming. He's the coach of Mary Tyson Lappin, and I saw her doing some pushing isometrics. I think she was pulling into a rack in a, like a snatch grip, kind of like a start position. But what would be, so given that there obviously would be differences in load with the pushing, I would assume like you would kind of get a bar and push into pins or pull into pins. I don't know how much weight you would have on there, but it's something where you can obviously move the bar and pull on it as hard as you can. What would be the differences in their implementation? So I would think that a pushing would be like, from my perspective, a little lower level, easier to use, maybe easing someone into training or trying to really solidify a more like granular position where you're not having the weight be kind of the limiting factor or using loads that can kind of push or pull people out of position. So what would be the differences between the two in terms of their implementation within a training program, say for a powerlifter or a weightlifter?
Yeah. So no, that's a great point in terms of the practicality and the different ability of beginners versus advanced trainees. So to your point, if you're using the pushing isometrics, like into a squat rack or the pins, I mean, you can do that with zero load, right? You could do that with just an empty barbell because then you get it up to that position where the rack or where the pins are and you push. And it actually doesn't matter how much weight is on the bar, I don't think. It would matter to get it into that position. But at that point, if you're pushing as hard as you possibly can, it doesn't matter that there's 150 kilos on the bar and you can push with an extra 30 kilos into the pin. Or does it matter if you just have an empty bar and you're pushing with 160 kilos, you know, 20 kilo bar plus your 160, that's still 180 kilograms of force. So, yeah, you could use an empty bar or for sure a light bar, and then you're not worried at all about, oh, well, if the person, you know, happens to lose balance, they lose their balance somehow and they fall. Okay, well, it sucks that they fell. It might not be nice or pleasant, but they just fell and they had a bar. So, you know, they're not going to be, it's not really that dangerous. And I mean, if you have somebody who's at least somewhat experienced at dropping a bar, then doing a holding isometric with that same 180 kilos is not so bad either. You know, they pop on out of it, you jump forward, the bar hits the ground. Maybe you're a little embarrassed, but not particularly tough. But if somebody is not that experienced, then they might go down into a squat position in a really awkward position, the bar is way over their toes, they're bent over, you know, the bar is not balanced on their foot. So there's a little bit of an extra skill there versus just pushing into a rack. But alternatively, holding that position will probably help that person find what their center is. It's like, you know, when I was training in weightlifting, so I competed in weightlifting as well. I don't know if you knew that, from like 18 until 23 or something like that. You know, and I wasn't amazing, but I was okay. And my coach would often have us do like snatch pulls where it was 4 seconds up and 4 seconds down. And the whole purpose of that was, you know, find your balance point, find where the barbell should be. You know, it's pretty hard to do a heavy snatch pull that takes 4 seconds where the bar is, you know, 10 inches away from your legs. You need that bar to be close or else you're just going to fatigue and you're not going to be able to actually do a snatch pull and the body will kind of fix itself, right? So there's potential benefits on both sides of it.
Yeah, and kind of as you were talking about that, I was imagining, it, because my mind immediately goes to weightlifting, which rightfully so, it's a weightlifting podcast, and doing some sort of pushing isometric where you're actually at the top of kind of like where the bar would be peaked when you're pulling underneath it and then actually pulling into a rack from that position. Because I find that it's hard to get a lot of, you know, specific work to the position where the elbows and hands are very high in the pull, just because balance tends to be a limiter. Like your ability to actually hold weight that high becomes a limiter. So you can do like upright rows, you can do, you know, high pulls, and you can kind of move through those positions a little more quickly. But it's really tough to get everything pulled as high as possible and then to create force from that position. So I'm wondering if that like exposure to that would have some sort of like motor control impact where people would one be able to get to the position more often because they're actually spending time there, like effective time, but then you're actually potentially creating more force in that higher pull position, so that it's, you know, you're able to kind of continue the pull as you kind of like finish the lift and go underneath it. What are your thoughts just kind of speculating on something like that, like putting in pushing isometrics for say like the top of a snatch pull or the top of a clean pull, into pins to kind of work the shoulders and arms?
Yeah. And so just to clarify, you're sort of meaning like high enough where the arms have already actually started to bend, to mimic your pulling under. Is that's sort of what you're envisioning?
Yeah, like the kind of like scarecrow position, right? Where the everything's as high as possible and you actually wouldn't be standing with a barbell in that position. You would actually be going down. But when you pull underneath it, you know, the elbow gets in line with the shoulder, the hand gets like right by the armpit. And then that's kind of when you flip the bar over. So it's kind of like just exaggerating that position at the top, so that your elbows are as high as possible and your hands are kind of as high as possible too.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's definitely worth a try. You know, of course, you wouldn't want to do only that and still want to practice the lift. But I think any coach would know that, hopefully. You never get too far away from the classic lifts. Although I'm sure some coaches will say, yeah, you probably don't need to. But yeah, I'd say it's definitely worth a try. And yeah, to your point, if you're normally in a weightless setting when you're at that position, you know, the feet are floating a little bit above the ground, you're pulling under. I mean, at that point, you're pulling on your body, not a bar. So I would imagine that would be very difficult to overload. And perhaps, yeah, perhaps a pushing style isometric on the very, very top part of that pull, that would be really interesting. I think there's some potential there. That's an idea, Josh.
Yeah, I'll have to trial that out because I have gone down this rabbit hole before, more like a thought rabbit hole of, you know, what's the actual contribution of the arms kind of after the bar leaves the hip. Or the top of the thighs, like, is it maintaining speed, creating speed, like doing anything significant, or is it more so like directional in nature? But I guess to be directional, you would have to apply some sort of force. So like, just trying to get a little more granular with understanding all that. as far as like the setting goes, I know. I'm aware of the fact that generally with in a more rehabilitation setting, you would set people up in specific joint angles to target where they might be more sensitive. Say if they have a bout of knee bola, right? You might put them at parallel and have them push against the pin because that's where they tend to be sensitive to movement. Is that kind of overwhelmingly where the pushing isometrics are applied in your experience? And what kind of effect, I guess, you have two questions bridging off of that is, would joint angle have on the adaptation? And does it matter to be pickier about kind of where you're positioned?
Yeah. So yeah, this kind of trail back to that systematic review on the isometric sort of training variables. And the joint angle was the one topic where there was a half decent number of studies. The rest of them in terms of intensity or intent were a little bit on the shallow side. But joint angle certainly seems to have a pretty good effect or fit pretty decently sized effect on what sort of adaptations come out of these training protocols. So I'll just start by saying that pretty much all of the studies included in that systematic review and almost all of the studies involved in like exercise science, for that matter, were on people who are either completely untrained or people that are just sort of like physically active, you know, like go on a hike on the weekend, they lift occasionally, not like elite athletes, for sure not elite strength athletes, very rare. But basically the findings were that when isometrics were performed at a longer muscle length, so you would, you know, if we use the squat, for example, if you're performing the isometrics closer to the bottom of a squat where the quads are going to be longer, then that particular joint angle or position is going to be beneficial for building muscle size. More so than if the joint angle is straighter and the quads are shorter. So that makes sense for a variety of reasons. We know that stretch mitigated hypertrophy is a factor in building muscle. We also know that when the muscle is stretched, then it's going to receive a little bit less blood flow. So we know that blood flow restriction also works for building muscle. So maybe there's sort of a mild blood flow restricting effect when you perform isometrics at longer muscle lengths. We also saw, for example, that when you held muscle or isometric contractions longer with a lower intensity, you got more hypertrophy than if you did really brief, rapid contractions. Once again, probably because you have some extra metabolic signaling at that point with the restricted blood flow and the preferential type 2 muscle fiber recruitment and things of that nature. So if your goal with isometrics is to build muscle, then it probably should be performed at longer, more stretched muscles. Mm-hmm. And then while difficult to say exactly, the strength gains that you would have are generally better when the isometrics are trained at a longer muscle length. Likely because you get more muscle, and probably muscle size is a good contributor to muscle strength. But muscle strength was almost always the best improved at or right around the joint angle that you trained at. So just to give an example, if you trained your knee extensors, your quads at a 90 degree joint angle, the most strength gain would be at that 90% or 90 degree joint angle. If you trained it at a really long muscle length, then strength gain would be better kind of throughout the length tension curve. So you would improve strength through the entire range of motion, but it would still be the best at whatever joint angle you actually trained at. So if you're really weak in one joint angle, then train at that joint angle. Don't worry about the long muscle length. If you just want to use isometrics to get stronger or bigger in a general sense, then the longer muscle length is most likely your go-to.
And you talked about people being particularly weak in one phase of the lift. If someone misses a squat, say like 3/4 of the way up, or you know, 2/3 of the way up, if we're just approximating, would you have them start at the exact position where the bar ceases to move during a maximal lift, or would you have them move down a little bit to where speed starts to slow a bit more? Yeah. So how would someone effectively decide where to put this isometric?
Yeah. Certainly not my research, but there for sure is one or two studies out there in the last few years showing that, yeah, like where you stick in the squat. And I mean, you knew this already, as did probably most of your listeners, you know, where you stop in a squat and where you fail in the squat. You know, that's, you know, I guess your sticking point, but in reality, it's because you didn't have enough speed coming into that position. So you would want to actually work on a slightly the position a little bit before you actually come to a stop. So if I'm trying to sort of merge those papers with the isometric type stuff, I'd say you probably want to go down about 15 degrees, 15 to 30 degrees. So if your sticking point is at 105 degrees, so just a little bit above, or just a little bit above when your knee's at 90, then you probably want to train, you know, with a pin squat at 90, or maybe 85 or 80 or something like that, so that you can continue to push that force through that phase where you're really getting slow. Because by the time you already stop, you're done. You're probably not going to be able to just muscle it out from that position where you're actually stuck. Mm.
Okay, so we've set someone up. They miss a squat in a certain position. We know where to put the bar. We know that we should apply kind of like maximal effort to the isometric that we're using. Have you noticed or found differences in the length of time spent in that isometric and the adaptation? And obviously, if we wanted to just be absurd about it, we would say, well, 1 second would be entirely different from 30 seconds or 2 minutes or 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. But given that most people, when you ask them, okay, I'm doing pause squats, how long should I pause? Around 2 to 3, you know, air quotes, seconds. I think we also call that a California stop, where it's more of a yield. But does the length of the isometric or time spent holding that position have a meaningful change on the adaptation if it's, say, 2 to 10 seconds or somewhere in between?
Yeah, 2 to 10 seconds. I think so, but I don't know so. So if we go back to the literature, then yeah, holding, if you accumulated the same amount of total time under tension, then but again, this is kind of in a vacuum, but in the studies where you have the same total amount of time under tension with the same total load or relative load, the longer the isometric is held to a point, the more hypertrophy you're going to get out of it. But if we're trying to just get through a sticking region in a squat, then you're probably going to want to be contracting at close to 100% effort, you know, 80% plus of your sort of perceived effort. Or, you know, if you had force plates, then I guess you could actually measure what is 90%, what is 80%. But most people, of course, don't have force plates that they can just pull out and put under a squat rack at any time. So again, just the combining the research with my sort of instinct and combining it with literature in other areas, I would say pushing at somewhere around 80 to 100% of max perceived effort for probably about 5 seconds would probably be, you know, 5, 6, 7 seconds would probably be about optimal. And that's simply because most people will take somewhere between 1 and 2 seconds to actually achieve their maximal peak force. And then you'd probably want to hold that for, you know, a few seconds after that point in order to just get enough of an exposure to the muscles and the tendons and things like that at that joint position at that intensity. 1 or 2 seconds to get there, a couple of seconds to kind of hold it there. That's probably going to be around 5 or 6 seconds in total. And then you'll want to repeat that for, you know, maybe 5 sets or five max contractions like that, with a few minutes rest between them, just to make it sort of practically relevant as well. You know, it's possible that you'd be better off with taking a full 10-minute break, but then you're at 50 minutes of isometric squats, and most people aren't full-time athletes, so they wouldn't be able to practically do that.
Right. And also, kind of as we dig into the kind of like practical side of things, the question that I generally would have, and I think this was a question that is pretty pretty common in the hypertrophy literature, or just I guess resistance training literature, not question but idea, is that if you equate work, so if you equate, you know, maybe it's percent 1RM on the bar, and then total work, however you're measuring that. So if it's just sets times reps times load, or times distance, or something like that. As long as you're doing similar work across conditions, you'll probably get roughly the same effect, at least like in hypertrophy literature. So, if you know, there's that study by Schoenfeld where I think one group did 3 sets of 10 with a certain weight, another group did 7 sets of 3, kind of equated like work, and then they saw similar effects on muscle size or change in muscle size. With isometric training specifically, if you did, say, 5 sets of 5 pause squat, or 5 sets of 3, or, you know, whatever set rep combination, and you took the same amount of work or total time under the bar, or like however you're measuring those things, and equated it without the isometric, do you think there would be kind of like similar effects? Or do you think the isometric itself has a really... are a strong enough effect that it would differentiate itself from just like quote unquote conventional training if you were to equate everything as much as possible?
Yeah. So people ask me this quite often because they, I don't know, I find it silly because I actually haven't done that much isometric research in the past. Like the vast majority of the research I've published is not have anything to do with isometrics. but because of that one systematic review, and because my PhD topic has the word isometric in it, you know, people, I have been called like the isometric guy, or, oh, you're the isometric dude, whatever. And I'm like, no, not really. And what I get even more often is people like, well, how do you use isometrics with the people you work with? And the honest answer there is, like, for the most part, I don't. Like, I do sometimes. I sometimes do some holds. I sometimes do some pushes into the pins, but I would be, like, it's never a surprise when I meet another strength coach who uses isometrics more than me. And that's because they have a time and place, but I don't look at them as being particularly special. Mm. If I have a client, whether it's general pop or an athlete or somebody pre or post surgery or whatever, if they can do dynamic movement, you know, if they're cleared from that by the doctor, or their joints are tolerating it really well, I'm almost always going to lift with them in a manner that's dynamic. And by dynamic, I mean eccentric, and then a concentric, and a, you know, just like normal lifting, going up and down, lift this weight for, you know, 4 sets of 8 or whatever you have. And, you know, we might mix in some tempo there just to make it easier on the joint. If they're a surgical patient, okay, we're going to go 3 seconds up and 3 seconds down. So there's no jolting at the bottom of the movement. So to sort of answer the last part of that multi-part question first is, no, I don't really think that isometrics have to be treated much differently than normal lifting, except that they're more difficult to quantify. So again, unless you have force plates, it's very difficult to quantify a pushing isometric, right? How hard are they pushing into the pin? Is that improved from week to week? No, you kind of have to use just perceived effort. Are they pushing as hard as they possibly can? Does it look like their face, you know, are they getting red in the face? But unless you have the force plates or something else, like the force hooks, which is a kind of a cool product that I've yet to try, it's going to be difficult to say, well, this week they put 180 kilograms into those hooks, Last week it was only 160. So, wow. Okay. The load is, you know, the relative load is going up substantially week to week. It's very difficult to do that without technology. But I think it's going to be pretty much the same as your dynamic training, where if you increase the volume, assuming they can still recover, that you're going to get more hypertrophy, you're going to get more strength data, just like if you're just squatting with a barbell or doing bicep curls or whatever else. So, I don't think they need to be treated all that differently.
Yeah, and from my perspective, thinking about it now, I think, and as you've kind of mentioned, there is going to be a motor control aspect to it. Can the person control the positions more effectively when they pause, and then find the correct positions or more reliably get there? So if you think about bench presses with a pause on the chest or pause slightly above, it's like just developing a stronger awareness of the position. So that is definitely probably one of the major reasons why I would use it. And you mentioned a tempo squat. It's kind of the same idea. It's slowing it down to the point where it has to be as precise as possible. And then it's also managing load effectively. And sometimes I think, you know, at least for myself, you write a training plan and it's like, oh, this looks perfect. And it's overwhelmingly too much, or there's just like too much of the same thing, or it's far too ballistic. So you put, you know, you almost put some buffers in there with isometrics or tempo work. An isometric is like a tempo lift, but putting like slower eccentric concentric movements or pauses, almost as a safeguard. So you can reduce the weight on the bar. You can make everything a little slower, kind of minimize impact a little bit more, make it more of a motor control thing than an absolute load or weight on the bar thing. So that's how I tend to incorporate them. I have found, and I don't know why this is, but I've had people who do squats with so if they squat with a 3 times a week frequency, and one of those days is isometrics, or 2 of those days would be like an isometric, so like a pause in the bottom, pause halfway up or something. Mm-hmm. I tend to find that people have better results in the squat, and I don't know if it's a higher level of effort on that day with the pauses, because it makes it harder. So using less weight on the bar still is like a really challenging workout versus taking the same weight on the bar and just doing a normal squat. Or if it's like a positional thing, just kind of shoring up those positions and getting stronger kind of like out of the bottom, where most people tend to lose position or kind of like, you know, quote unquote melt or squish or whatever you want to call it. So I found that they tend to be helpful. I've thought about like why, and that's kind of, that was the heart of my question. Is it just a work thing, or is it like a unique property to an isometric?
Yeah. I think it's just a work thing. I don't think there's a real specific special thing there in terms of recovery or benefit. But it did, when you were kind of explaining all of that, it did make me think about a little bit of the sort of psychology behind training as well, and the fact that you might add in a wrinkle or two or something a little bit different, where you're doing some pause stuff or some tempo stuff, or you're occasionally integrating that max effort push into a pin, or these types of things, and just simply keeping training fresh and different from month to month or from training cycle to training cycle is, I don't think that's a trivial aspect of preparation. I don't think there's all that much special behind using chains, for example. There might be a little bit of, you know, physiology or biomechanics or whatever involved in chains, but if I'm squatting with chains, like, I mean, I'm 32, almost 33. Like, can I get stronger? Sure. Is it a massive priority in my life? No. But do I like lifting weights? Yes. so I'll throw some chains in there for a month, because I'm like, oh, this gets me excited to train. I'm going to go into the gym and I'm going to load on some chains and I'm going to make some noise and do something a little bit different than I've normally done. And that's going to allow me to push squats really hard when I haven't had the motivation to push squats really hard for the last 6 months. So athletes might find the same thing. Oh, cool. Today we're doing this like max effort push into the pins followed by some med ball tosses. Like that's different. That's going to make me so much more explosive. And, you know, and it might, but it might just because now they're working harder and that's where they're getting the benefit as opposed to any sort of, you know, scientific revelation that you've made.
Right. No, that makes sense. Are there, and I guess we talked about muscle hypertrophy, talked a bit about kind of like positional effects, which built in is kind of like, you know, the force component of it. As far as the like a tendon's response to isometrics, would there be any benefit to, and I don't know how many people think about tendons when they're programming, unless, you know, someone's got some sort of like aches and pains that they're dealing with, like knee pain that might be more specific to the tendon. I don't even know how much that is in like the wheelhouse of the people listening. But is there any reason why you would consider tendon adaptations when it comes to isometrics, especially for people who are focused on performance?
So there's kind of two things here. One, I think, has been known for a good while, and the other, I think, is an emerging branch of research that I was quite excited when I found a couple of papers while I was, you know, picking away at that systematic review on pushing versus holding that I mentioned. So the first is kind of stems, maybe it stems from earlier, but in my mind, it stems from a paper by Ebony Rio and a group of researchers out of, I want to say La Trobe in Australia, but that doesn't really matter, to be honest. But they examined using isometrics versus, you know, just sort of traditional leg extensions or whatever for basically reducing tendon pain acutely. So the paper itself was really exciting when it came out because it found a pretty large effect in that performing some isometric knee extensions like dramatically improved pain, at least temporarily. And since then, there's been some studies that have found, you know, either similar or completely asimilar results, and, you know, kind of go back to that original one. And the sample size was very small. And if you look at the real data behind it carefully, one or two massive outliers really seem to affect the entire thing. So it kind of was like, oh, darn. But that being said, if even 40% of the athletes that you try it on get a really strong positive effect, then it might be worth trying. And if they don't get an effect, then great. You air quotes wasted one session, but if it does work beautifully, then you've just found a fantastic tool for that particular athlete that's going to help them progress. So that's one. They might be able to do an isometric hold before a training session and then have a much more normal training session where they can snatch and they can clean and jerk and, you know, maybe you still kind of back off and do muscle snatches instead of power snatches, or, you know, focus on the poles for a while instead of heavy power cleans where they're catching the bar with the, you know, like that POW type of a catch that's going to be pretty tough on the knees, or can be pretty tough on the knees. But the isometric training in general, the great thing about it is that you can really control what joint angle somebody is at. So if they're having a lot of pain at the middle portion of a squat, well, you can do isometric holds above that position and you can do isometric training below that position and completely avoid the spot where they're having a lot of pain and issues. And probably any sort of tendon adaptation you're going to get is going to help them with all of the ranges of motion, not just the ones you're going to train at. So morphological adaptations, kind of like how the long muscle length training helped strength throughout the range of motion, likely because it improved muscle mass. If you do the isometrics to improve tendon structure, which they do, or at least have the potential to, then that's going to reduce pain, no matter where in the range of motion they're using that new tendon structure. So that's sort of one. And then the second one, or the second point, and I believe there's only two papers on this, and they're very specific. They're probably in journals that most strength and conditioning coaches would never look in, like, I don't know, like Journal of Neurophysiology and whatever else, I can't remember exactly. But they're from another group in Australia who looks mostly at back pain, but for some reason they decided to do some studies with patellar tendon pain. So what they did was they injected patellar tendons of participants with a sort of saline solution that essentially causes temporary pain without any actual damage, but it mimics tendon pain, basically. And then they would have them perform either pushing isometrics or the holding isometrics, and then they would perform like nerve stimulation and EMG stuff and all these real kind of crazy measures. And they found that there was less inhibition to the muscle when the person was performing the holding isometric versus the pushing. So the pushing was creating, hypothetically, and again, this is somebody who's not a neurophysiologist, so I'm just kind of reading the paper and trying to understand it as best I can. But the pushing was causing enough pain, or a certain type of pain, where it was inhibiting the muscle function, whereas the holding, the muscle function was a lot more normal, even though the actual force going through the muscle was, you know, practically identical. So then that might lead you to believe that doing holding isometrics might be better tolerated in the short term than pushing isometrics in somebody who's got a painful tendon. Mm.
Yeah, I think that was for someone who isn't the isometric guy, that was a pretty complete treatment of the topic, or at least for an hour on a podcast. So Dustin, if people want to read the paper and check out more of your work, and check out future work that you're kind of working on at the moment, where can they find you and reach out to chat about it?
Yeah, so probably the best place to see any research is going to be my ResearchGate page. So for those of you who are not familiar, there's a website called ResearchGate.net. And then you just search for my name, or in Google, just search for my name, Dustin Ornchuk, and then ResearchGate or anything like that. And even though sometimes, you know, it shouldn't be, you're not technically allowed to post papers online without the link and all that, usually people can get away with it on ResearchGate. So almost all of my papers are uploaded there. You don't need to, they're not behind a paywall, or anything like that. And if there are papers that are behind a paywall, then probably messaging me on Twitter or Instagram is a fine way to get a hold of me. So the Twitter handle there is just at Dustin Ornchuk, no underscores, no nothing like that. And then Instagram, I'm just going to check so I don't say anything stupid. It's just dustin.ornchuk.phd. So you can send me a message, and if there's something, a question you might have, usually I'm okay at getting back to you within a day or two if I can.
Yeah, and for everyone listening, do reach out to Dustin. Maybe chew on this episode a little bit, not physically, but intellectually chew on it, and think about maybe some unique applications of isometric exercises, and ask him away. You can follow me on Instagram at Josh_PhilWL. You can kind of support the brand everywhere. It's at Philosophical Weightlifting. If you want to buy some Onyx merch or Weightlifting House stuff, use the code PhilWL, PHILWL, for 10% off. And that goes directly into my pocket, which I do appreciate. Well, 10% does, which isn't an overwhelming amount. So it's actually peanuts when you think about it. But until next time, we will catch you guys next week on another episode of the Philosophical Weightlifting Podcast.